This show was previously broadcast live on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com.
Godspeed, an enlightening and positive forum exploring the world's religions and spiritual practices in an effort to better understand each other and foster peace. Through conversations with experts worldwide, this weekly program is an on-air classroom aimed at helping listeners gain insight into religious and spiritual practices around the world. I'm your host, Carol Hallenbeck. In the beginning has been a phrase running around my head these past few days. And joining us today is a guest who can shed light on the beginning of religion in the world, the beginning of religious worship, of spiritual ritual, of acknowledging and responding to the sacred. Dr. Jacob Needleman is a professor of philosophy at San Francisco State University and former director of the Center for the Study of New Religions at the Graduate Theological Union in Berkeley, California. He was educated in philosophy at Harvard, Yale, and the University of Freiburg, Germany. He has also served as research associate at the Rockefeller Institute for Medical Research, as a research fellow at Union Theological Seminary, as adjunct professor of medical ethics at the University of California Medical School, and as guest professor of religious studies at the Sorbonne, Paris, in 1992. He is a prolific author, and his books include The New Religions, a pioneering study of the New American Spirituality, The Wisdom of Love, Money and the Meaning of Life, A Sense of the Cosmos, Lost Christianity, The Heart of Philosophy, The Way of the Physician, Time and the Soul, Sorcerers, a novel, The American Soul, Why Can't We Be Good, and the essential Marcus Aurelius. He was featured on Bill Moyers' PBS series, A World of Ideas, and today we will also discuss his latest book, What is God?, recently published by Tarcher Putnam. Dr. Needleman, welcome.
Well, so good to be here.
Oh, I'm glad to be speaking with you. That is a lengthy list of accomplishments and achievements. And something tells me in our corporate structure that to get to the very essence of who you are and your life experience, that the resume pales in comparison
to your spiritual journey. It is, when I hear that, all that long list of things, I sometimes say, I would like to meet that person.
Yeah.
Hey.
He sounds great, doesn't he? Well, congratulations on the book.
Thank you
very much. I love
much.
It. It's beautiful.
I put myself into that book.
You put yourself into that book.
Put a lot of myself into that most recent book, which I try to do that with all my books, but this one is a little more personal than some of the others.
Really? In what way? What makes this one more personal?
It really tells in literal detail some of the essential steps I took from passage from atheism, from really not having really any meaningful connection to religion as I was a young person, to discovering more and more the depths and profundity of the world's great spiritual traditions, and finally to working in a way inwardly, experientially, to what I discovered to be an experiential verification of the existence of something higher in ourselves and in the universe.
I understand that originally, as you say, you call yourself atheistic, existential, and unwilling to blindly accept childish religiosity.
Yes.
I think a lot of people can relate to that.
Yeah, I think so, too.
In general. So too. But what was it, then, that would stimulate the inner journey that started decades ago?
It started with a job teaching philosophy in a long time ago, in 1962, at San Francisco State University, where I was obliged by the needs of the university and the department and the charter to teach at least one course in the history of Western religious thought that was supposed to be taught for people who might be preparing for the clergy. And I reluctantly agreed to do it because I was reluctant because I really had no real feeling for that material. But I honorably did my best to prepare for it by reading in material that I never thought I would be reading carefully in. And in that preparation for teaching this course, I discovered that I had not really understood or appreciated what is deeply inside the teachings of the Christian tradition or the Judaic tradition. That all my education, even at some very fine universities, had not prepared me to appreciate what's there. And the more I taught, the more I went into it, the more I was amazed and touched and extraordinarily impressed by the depth of thought, particularly the depth of thought in the spiritual, mystical traditions of our Western culture. And then eventually, and then being living in San Francisco, coming in touch in the late 1960s with all the people coming from the East, the teachers and gurus, some of whom were very authentic, many of whom, of course, many of that people from that movement were, at the very least, you could say, awkward about it. But coming in touch with the real deeper meaning of the Eastern traditions, Buddhism, Hinduism, I certainly, my whole orientation and respect for religion grew more and more deep. So from that on, it was just one each year teaching this material and then practicing myself. I came to see what I felt were absolutely great traditional spiritual ideas in philosophy as well as in religion. And that such ideas are very desperately needed in our culture, particularly for our younger generation.
Now, during that time in the late 60s, you discovered a core of esoteric philosophical ideas within the traditional religious texts.
Absolutely.
That were more mature. You say the ideas were more mature and challenging than anything you had ever associated before with Judaism, Christianity, and the religions of the East. Could you speak a little of that core and what you found mature and challenging?
Well, I think there's so many things. but the idea that maybe the main idea that at the heart of the great spiritual traditions there is an inner path of inner self-perfection, inner self-spiritual maturation and development. You might call it a spiritual psychology at the heart of the Christian, the Judaic, Islamic, Buddhist, etc. tradition. That it was very sophisticated. The whole idea of states of being, states of consciousness, the meaning, the inner meaning of faith, the inner meaning of love in the Christian and Judaic sense, the inner meaning of sacrifice and submission, the inner meaning of obedience, of God's demand on, or even the very word God, how childishly I had looked upon that word for so many years. There's a core there. All of the great traditions are like paths starting from different places, different environments, which lead to the same, you might say, mountain. And to ascend that mountain to an inner state of faith or righteousness or the kingdom of heaven, whatever word or realization in the Hindu tradition or Satori or Nirvana, to ascend that mountain is very much similar in all of the path, the way, the work of ascending that inner mountain is very comparable in all of the great traditions, even though the path starting from far away from the mountain, the different cultures and traditions can be very different, even contradict each other because they start from different places and have to make different strategies for the development of the person's life.
Yes, and I think in the early days, early Christianity was actually called the Way.
Oh, yes. of course, it's a way of, and in the Hebraic tradition also, the way to sin in one sense is simply, not simply, but is mainly to go off the way, off the path, or miss the mark, as it is in the Christian tradition. It's not some kind of parental or childish disobedience of some puritanical principle or something of that kind where people get their hands slapped or punished. It's the punishment or the price of going off the path or off the way is to lose the meaning of your life.
These words like surrender or obedience have gotten sort of a bad reputation in American culture, to say the least, and we have a never say die and never surrender kind of mentality often in our culture, and I think we perhaps have lost contact with that essence of what it means of to surrender to new growth, the kind of strength that calls for it, and it is not a quitting. And that the word obedience, I learned, is actually a 13th century word that actually means to listen or to give ear to. It does not mean to submit or to be submissive as we understand it today. And people, recoil away from the word obedience. But it really invites, when we truly are obedient, when we truly listen to our inner self or our spouse or our child, then we're really present or can be, rather than always respond with the usual sort of retort in a conversation. We can actually be present. It sounds like what you're saying is not the same thing as all religions are the same or all religions have a common thread, but rather that they have they offer something distinct, but essentially similar at the core.
I think so. the word listening is very good that you bring that in. Even in the Judaic, very beginnings of the Judaic tradition, hear, O Israel, to listen, receive. Obedience as a kind of, it's got a bad reputation. Because it seems to mean something passive, something where you sacrifice your individuality, your
inner loss
freedom.
Of some kind.
But in the deeper meaning of obedience, like listening to each other or listening to something deeper in oneself, what you're sacrificing is an illusion or is something which is actually preventing your individuality, your true individuality, from developing. So that obedience to what is greater and truer in oneself is by no means a giving surrender of individuality, but in a way, a real true discovery of it.
Yes, the deliverer of your true self.
I would say so. And the true self is the part of oneself that can say honestly that I am, which is sometimes understood to be the name of God in one interpretation.
Now, you also wrote a book called Lost Christianity, and yes. I'm interested in finding out what have we lost? What was lost?
It's been lost, and what is now many more people are trying to find it is some kind of thing that Thomas Merton discovered, and many people more and more these days, that at the heart of the Christian tradition there is a spiritual discipline, a science of spiritual growth requiring a community of people who work diligently and faithfully with each other to be a community of willing to search together for the truth inside and the ability to manifest it in love outwardly. It's an inner psychological, which you might call, for lack of in shorthand terms, a spiritual psychology, a practical spiritual psychology at the heart of the Christian tradition. And I think the emphasis on morality, which is very interesting and good, but the emphasis on ritual, forms of worship can be very healthy and very necessary, but it also, when it's separated too much from the spiritual psychology part, can become petrified and even superstitious, and lead to a kind of mixture with human aspects such as egoism and power hungry and greed, in which case religion can become a source of great destruction and harm in our world as we see it around us. So what that book was about was the possible rediscovery of the deep spiritual psychology that's at the heart of the Christian tradition, which you find in great mystics of the spiritual, of the Christian tradition, such as Meister Eckhart, which you find so strongly in the Eastern Orthodox tradition of Christianity, particularly in the early centuries of the Desert Fathers. And you find it in what is called and mistakenly interpreted as the Gnostic aspects of Christianity, which also are very deeply faithful and have been misunderstood for centuries.
How have they been misunderstood?
Well, they've been misunderstood as denying the divinity of Christ. They've been misunderstood as emphasizing knowledge, which seems to be a Promethean kind of self-inflation, of emphasizing knowledge, of treating Jesus as mere human. They've been emphasized as they've been misinterpreted because some of their texts, most of their texts, have been destroyed, and the ones that have survived have been taken too literally, and some of them seem to be offensive, and some of them seem to be against the official doctrines of the church, and all that needs to be, the good and the bad and the authentic and the inauthentic have to be separated from all that material, and it can only be separated by people who inwardly have experienced some deep spiritual truth so that they can tell which part may be authentic and which not. External evidence is not the main thing there, because unless you have an internal sensitivity coming from your own internal experience of these matters, it's almost impossible to know what's really authentic and what isn't. I hope that doesn't sound too radical.
No. No. No, I understand. I understand that when in your earlier days, I'm just getting back to what is God now, so we can share more about your book, that you had an unsettling meeting with the Zen teacher Suzuki.
Oh, yes. That was
what was
great.
Unsettling about that? You know, Merton had a very unsettling meeting, too, with his uncle once that led him on his journey.
Meeting a spiritual teacher of any kind, if he's authentic, has got to be unsettling because, well, let me tell you about D.T. Suzuki.
Yes.
As I describe it in the book, it was I was just a young graduate student in philosophy, and I was interested in the philosophical questions, etc. One of the questions was, what is the self, which had been, as an existentialist philosopher, I was very interested in that question, because one of my favorite philosophers, who is a truly great Christian thinker, Søren Kierkegaard, had been deeply concerned and articulated that question very strongly about inwardness and the self. And I had been trying to find my own spiritual path, and I had a chance to meet E.T. Suzuki, who was then quite old, remarkably looking man, great presence, startling sense of silence about him, which he had a kind of an inner power when I met him. I was very nervous and so forth, but all this is leading up to the time when I was sitting in the same room with him, and I poured out my question to him, what is the self? And I had all my philosophical ideas in my mind ready to have a long, long, insightful discussion with him, prove how smart I was, perhaps. And he just looked at me and said, and gave a very good Zen answer, but at the time it just threw me for a loop. He said, who is asking the question? Who is asking the question is not a response to that kind of a question that I ever had or would have dreamt to have had. it's certainly the kind of response you get in Zen teachings, but it dumbfounded me, and I actually said something in answer to him that I thought was, because I was really troubled by that kind of answer, and even annoyed. And I said, well, I'm asking the question. And he looked at me continually, looked at me, and he said, well, show me this I. And that just silenced me. I didn't know what the heck to make of that. And I was very disappointed and very stunned by it. And I left very disappointed for a long time, for many months in my university, where I was writing my philosophy books, philosophy essays. And then I woke up in the middle of the night. I realized he was actually communicating something to me in a deeply compassionate way to show me that I had to discover the answer to that question by myself, by my own realization, which I did up to a point, just a little bit, in the middle of the night, waking up from a deep sleep, saying to myself, I see what he's been doing. That really was a great discovery. It made me realize there was such a thing as what Kierkegaard called indirect communication, what we might call spiritual communication, where you communicate to someone not explicitly by words, but through creating a situation where the person is obliged and able to discover something for themselves inwardly.
Often it seems to me that seekers from the West who turn to the East for answers often are turned back to their own culture by the very spiritual leaders they seek out to find their answers. And I'm wondering if you would agree that, I can of course speak as an American, these days with the emphasis on morality, as you were saying before, in the Christian church, perhaps a lot of people have thrown out the baby Jesus with the bathwater, let's say, in our culture, and are turning often to the more Eastern religions or philosophies for their spiritual searching and expression. And I'm wondering, will they find the same thing if they get down to the core of the the essence of the spiritual teaching, whether it's Buddhism or Christianity, if there's a sort of a turning back and sifting and finding the same core spiritually and the same gifts and benefits?
Yes, well, of course, religion is such a vast, vast thing, vast subject, and covers so many things throughout the world and the history of humanity. There's so many forms that are strong and some which are corrupt. But in the East, this case you're mentioning, it very often will happen that a younger person will turn to an Eastern tradition because of a disillusionment or lack of interest in his or her own tradition, whether it's Judaism or Christianity, and in the long run come back, the Eastern teachings, say Buddhism, will open his or her own eyes to the meaning of the Christian tradition itself. And this will lead them back to a deeper appreciation for their own tradition. This happens quite often now. Some don't. Some stay with the Buddhism or the Hinduism or the yoga or the Sufism. But many come back to their own spiritual tradition, their own religion, in its mystical or contemplative sense, not just in its external sense of ritual and moral commands. And I think the church, and I know the Judaic teachers of the Judaic tradition, are trying, many of them, to meet that need by rediscovering the spiritual, the mystical, contemplative, you want to call it esoteric, aspects of their own tradition. And many of the rabbis and ministers and priests that I've met are themselves seekers after the same kind of thing in their own tradition. So I think there is a positive convergence taking place, but not always. Sometimes they leave and stay having left, and find something very beautiful and very real, say, in Buddhism. And I could say, I would say, those who find their depth of such a great depth of meaning in, say, the Tibetan Buddhist or the Zen Buddhist tradition are in fact, if not in name, finding the very same thing. We're on the way to finding the very same thing that, say, a Meister Eckhart or a Hildegard of Bingen or John of the Cross or the Kabbalistic teachers speak of in their own language, in their own tradition. In fact, there are many, say, let's say, sermons of Meister Eckhart, I could point out, that you only have to change one or two words and it could be a Buddhist master. Or there are many Buddhist teachings written down. You only have to change one or two words and it would sound just like a Christian mystic. It's astonishing the convergence that takes place when you get deeply into the contemplative side of spiritual tradition.
Yes, well, thank you, Dr. Needleman. We're going to take a break for a moment, and perhaps when we come back, you could perhaps share with us more about the book, perhaps how it might help young people, and perhaps any particular practice you've enjoyed along your spiritual journey. Today is also the Chinese New Year, in addition to Valentine's Day, and we've selected an Asian new piece of music for our segue here. This is called The Moon Laughing. We'll be right back. And welcome back to Godspeed on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm your host, Carol Hallenbeck, and we're here with Dr. Jacob Needleman talking about his new book, What is God, among other things. We can also open up the call-in line now for anyone who might have some questions for Dr. Needleman. The phone number is 888-873-4643. Again, that's 1-888-873-4643. Hello there, Dr. Needleman.
Hello. Here I am.
There you are. And do you think that your book, What is God, could be helpful, especially to younger people today, giving the benefit of many decades of your experience and your searching?
I deeply hope so. I wrote it with very much with my own son and daughter in mind sometimes, and I feel it's, in brief, there are many toxic ideas circulating now in our culture that are more of a pollution of our world even than some of the environmental pollution we have. There are ideas which prevent people from acknowledging that something higher in universe and in oneself, something that could bring great hope, higher quality within our own being, or which prevent independent thought, which is such a central part. Some my writing, particularly this book, is I tend to try to bring ideas into the world that really can bring hope and a deeper understanding of our great possibilities as a human being, and also nourish the impulse to think independently and mainly to listen to each other in a way that can produce not just more intelligence, but more approach to love. So I think this book, I hope this book will be read by younger people.
It might help them along their journey, too. Where do you think the toxic ideas that you refer to might come from, and what might some of them be?
Well, the what we could call scientism or reductionism, that all the refined and extraordinary, truly spiritual, wondrous aspects or possibilities within human nature are really down deep, just material caused by impulses relating to drives for mere physical survival, primitive impulses, primitive motivations of power and sexual attraction, and all the rest that we attribute maybe erroneously to so-called primitive human beings. They're all reduced to the animal drives, no insult to animals intended, of course. And they're reduced to such things that they actually make it seem as though they're the deepest spiritual impulses, moral impulses, and love impulses, aesthetic sensitivities, are reduced to fundamentally survival mechanisms in a physical world, which is to completely deny the actual nature of the human self.
Mm-hmm.
So that's not science. That's scientism. Scientism,
yes,
comes when you take scientific methods and scientific ideas and apply them indiscriminately to all aspects of human and spiritual life and imply that there's no other way of knowing than that. The other kind of toxic idea would be more in the extreme fundamentalism, not fundamentalism in its pure sense, which I respect, but the extremities of that, which is implying a kind of violence, but also which is as a force against thinking for oneself. We must be free to think for ourselves, and when religion becomes a kind of dogmatism in the negative sense of the term, yeah, I would call that a toxic idea.
Yes,
toxic influence.
And if we're in a culture that's saying, you know, buy this and focusing on materialism and the self, and then the
yes.
church's response is basically, no, don't do that, it's wrong, but not filling anything else, there's a void that's not
that's
addressing
right.
the actual spiritual core of the individual and even, you know, the community or the church community, being
yeah.
on a journey together in community.
Yes, I see. You said that very well. That's very well put. Is that you can tell people not to do this or that, but then where do you leave them? You have to provide something positive, not just deny something which people want to be. That, too, is there are toxic ideas coming both sides of there. But you have ideas which are now becoming more and more suspect by many people that just getting things, having lots of pleasure, etc., brings meaning to your life. That is becoming more and more clear that is not the case. People are in despair because of that. And if the church can't provide a real vision of the deeper spiritual self within ourselves, then they're just creating, as you very well put it, a void and causing more despair.
Well, I have found that certain, you know, people along the timeline, you know, of Christianity say, people we would call saints or mystics, Teresa of Avila, for example, Francis of Assisi, Claire of Assisi, John of the Cross, you mentioned. I find a lot of in that tradition a kind of antidote to the sort of parental role that the institutional church takes on, and a lot of the perhaps timeless essential wisdom coming through the mystic tradition in the church. And I do think some people, more and more people, are turning to that in some way to fill this need that they know is inside them, even if it's not named. But as you say, as you say, you know, the actual nature of the human being. What can you speak to that? What, how would you describe the actual nature of the human being?
Well, there's many levels there, but the very beginning would be to realize that we are born with a yearning to serve and connect with something higher than ourselves, to understand it and to serve it in love, and that is our essence as a human being. It's much more fundamentally human than our biological or social or conditioned makeup, which our psychologists and biologists have told us is our most essential self. Our most essential aspect, our most defining human aspect, involves what Plato called eros, which is the love of truth, the wish to serve the higher and understand what is higher. And that has been suppressed in the culture. It's what I call, in another book of mine, a metaphysical suppression that has a repression that is more damaged than any of the other repressions. So that's where I would start. The other levels of human nature.
I don't think most folks would describe eros the way you just did. Could I hear that
again? Oh, because the term has come to be associated maybe with sexuality, but its original meaning is an inner yearning to understand and to participate in something higher. And sexual, or the love relationship, is a step toward that for Plato.
The love relationship.
Yes, the love relationship, not simply the sex, but the love relationship, which also can involve the sexual relationship. It's nothing contradictory there. It's just one thing cannot be separated from the other.
That's true. That's true. I find in a true love marriage scenario that, you know, the four loves that have been written about so often, eros, philia, storge, mm-hmm. and agape,
mm-hmm.
I find them all operating in
Absolutely.
Marriage, in a good marriage.
Good marriage, yes.
They are all operating, and no one writes about that yet.
I try to a little bit in the book called The Wisdom of Love, which is a book that has to do with what two people can do to support each other's spiritual nature. And I think
the
you
wisdom
hit it right
of
on.
Love?
All good marriage involves all that. But it's marriage is difficult, isn't it? It's work, it's what we're meant for.
Now, you mentioned before you made the distinction of scientism
yes.
as being distinct from scientific.
Yes.
I happen to enjoy science, and I don't find that it I find that it informs my faith.
Oh, yes.
Particularly the space sciences. I've always been attracted to the workings of what is actually out there in the fabric of creation and the nature of it. And I found, for example, themes like death and resurrection throughout creation itself. And I'm wondering if you could speak, because I think you have also the book A Sense of the Cosmos.
Absolutely.
And I know you also work in the scientific community and the medical community as well. How does that work for you as a person of religion, of faith, and how do you bring your vast journey and experience to this scientific and medical culture that we're in today?
Well, I started as a scientist, and science was my first love. Still is my great love, and to read... hear what science is discovering about the universe touches the deepest parts of a human being. And what we're talking about, in a way, one aspect of it is this, the true sense of wonder. And the sense of wonder is a spiritual feeling, it's a genuine feeling, a non-egoistic emotion, one of the few that we all can relate to. And that is, in its deepest sense, a spiritual feeling, a spiritual aspect of science. It, apart from any religious language, you don't have to have any religion or any sectarian beliefs or any talk about God or not God. The sense of relationship to the greatness and the order of the universe and the cosmos and down to the tiniest cell or bit of life, this is spiritual. And that's also science. And science is an honorable way of attaining knowledge, but it has its limits. And there's an inner work scientific evidence tends to be dependent upon sense perception, logic, and experiment in the outer world. But there's an inner world, too, that science doesn't recognize or isn't even supposed to, really, in a way. An inner world that is just as rigorous with its lawfulness, has just as much evidence involved as anything science has for the outer world. And that's what I call in my book, inner empiricism, as opposed to the exterior empiricism of science. The great mystics, the great spiritual leaders, Buddha, probably Jesus, all, including the great saints, worked in the inner world that was with just as much rigor and honesty and verification as anybody in the external world. So science remains a great love of mine. Who does not feel the sense of the sacred looking at any simple biological phenomenon? And even evolution, which is not opposed to spirituality, religion, just has developed a kind of what I would call Darwinolatry, which is an idolization of something called Darwinism, which is not the same thing as evolution as being a process of the development of species and life, which may be the way organism, living wholes may develop through a mechanical process. It doesn't mean it's all mechanical. It means the mechanical process serves a living process, serves a living purpose. But that's to get into some philosophical niceties that probably we don't have time for.
Well, you know, it's interesting. We're living in such a high-tech age where young people, you know, literally hold in the palm of their hand just about the entire world right now. And communication.
One version of it, okay.
One version of it, you know, but I mean, they can access each other and anything and information and, you know, Google their way around and look at the other side of the world and never have to go anywhere, and it's right in their hand.
Right.
And the messaging is instant and the communication is instant. And in some ways, you know, science is pushing right up to the boundary there of this, you know, this instantaneous, almost getting off the ground, flying kind of way of living with thought. And but at the same time, as you say, I don't know that the awareness of the wonder of that and how sacred that is connecting yet, you know, with the young people who are used to this. To me, it's we didn't have the ATM yet when I was in college, and it's moving so fast. Every year, it's moving faster and faster.
It tends to keep our sense of identity in our head, in the head, in the brain, in the mind, intellect, isolated intellect, with certain emotional reactions part of it. And that's ignoring about 90% of the human psyche, the feeling, the heart, the instinct, the sensation, the body as an instrument of knowing, the feeling as an instrument of deep knowing, and the cultivation of inner feeling of love, of sensitivity, of compassion, of understanding. This is terrifying if we're getting more and more squeezed into one small part of the psyche, and it looks like progress only to that one small part. In fact, it's a movement downward, probably. And what I said in the book is when our knowledge races so far ahead of the development of our being, we're racing toward destruction. And I think that it's pretty much clear the way the dangers that are facing us are, in part due to applications of science called technology, which far outstrip our moral and inner development. So it's one of the toxic aspects that we have to. When I taught a course recently, a few years ago, in Emerson, Ralph Waldo Emerson's essays,
yes,
who I would recommend to anybody now as a great American thinker, I was afraid it would be too complex or too subtle for some of my college students. In fact, to make a long story short, they loved it, and I asked them why, because Emerson's ideas are just the kind of ideas we need. I asked them why, and it wasn't because Emerson was optimistic, although he is that. It was because his thought touched the part of themselves that has never been touched and is not being helped, not being supported. This where Eros lives, this part of the heart that wishes to know and serve. That part gets touched and awakened. That brings hope. And I don't see that the technology, internet kind of thing, is doing that. It doesn't mean it's bad. It just means if we don't touch that other part of ourselves or open that part of into the body as well, then I don't want to sound scary, but I think it's a very dangerous time.
Yes, and I think, I mean, as you say, getting pushed into one particular part of our brain, I mean, obviously it almost calls for some kind of a, if not a paradigm shift, somehow the pendulum is going to need to swing at some point when perhaps a whole generation realizes that they want to maybe unplug and go take a walk out in the woods and look at
Well, it is changing a little. I think there's good signs of hope because I think so many of the younger people I meet now are really, for one reason or another, and sometimes they're very good reasons, they really want to get out and help and do something and travel somewhere to help people who are suffering, help the poor, help people in trouble. There's such a need to serve, to give. If that can be respected and honored without being exploited and interpreted, over-interpreted so much, and moralized too much, then I think the young people are the hope in that sense.
I agree. They're also, in a sense, in between a bit of a rock and a hard place these days, as the educational system has become so goal-oriented and achievement-oriented and test-score-oriented and is demanding so much of our young people. I don't know how that helps to inspire them or help them to begin thinking with their heart.
Not only
their heads for test scores, which are, you know, great cause of stress, in fact, among young people today in middle and high school and college. What is your advice on how do we create more balance so that we think not only with our brains, which are a great gift, but also with our heart?
You're so right, and that has to be done. Maybe it starts with parents, with the ordinary people recognizing the situation. So maybe within the religious traditions, within the churches and synagogues, and where there's, because it's true, the educational system is getting more and more cued to getting jobs and being successful in that sense out there, and less and less tuned to the deepest meaning of education, which is to come in touch with some deeper meaning in oneself and life. So maybe it starts with the public beginning to recognize that this is happening to their young people, that they're being twisted and forced into just becoming producers rather than true human beings. I don't know if it can start within the educational system. I know that there are many heroes teaching high school and elementary school who see this. Maybe they need to be supported too, have some kind of a network of educators who recognize the value of just understanding pure and simple, appreciating pure and simple great ideas. It's a crisis. I also find a little trouble with the Olympics and the gold medal worship, which implies that the whole purpose of life is winning. Isn't that an aspect of what you're speaking about?
Yes, and for me, winning is about the game of life. it's an inner journey of, you know, character and choices and values and, you know, how I raise my kids and those decisions is where my idea of success is. I just want to remind our listeners, if they didn't get the phone number before and would like to call in with a question, the number is 888-873-4643. I've got about 5 more minutes, Dr. Needleman, and I wanted to ask you if you could share with us any particular practice or discovery or worship or ritual, something in your life that has special meaning or that you have found especially helpful or beneficial?
Well, I would, there's so many things, but I would say in a short period of time would be the work of listening to each other. To try to experiment very often with in our classes and with people, with myself, when people disagree, to have it, to listen and have this experiment where this person who is spoken to has to repeat what the first person says in essence, in the way that the first person will say that's a fair statement. And only then can the second person take their point of view. And this goes back and forth. So it requires that you listening is a work, an inner work, as you know. It means separating from your own thoughts, your own opinions, and having a space inside to let the other person in. It doesn't mean agreeing with them and disagreeing with them. It means letting them in. And the result of this kind of inner work of listening is that people may wind up still strongly disagreeing with each other, but recognizing each other's humanity. Whereas nowadays what you get is people who disagree with me are hate and I want to kill them. There's nothing but shouting going on in our conversation. So I would say, and to make it brief, the art of listening, the work of listening as an inner meditative spiritual work of listening to the other, that listening, work of listening is the first step of ethics, which is in such crisis in our society. Because when you really listen to another person, you are manifesting a form of love which is very real and very practical, very possible for us to practice.
Do you think that this level of listening is possible on the world stage between, say, the world religions?
Who basically are
yelling, I am right.
Yeah. It's possible with people if they try it, to get them to try it. That's the problem. On that world stage, it's almost impossible because nobody wants to try it. It's like I would revise an old saying, you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make him thirsty. I mean, you can sit people down and tell them to listen, but they've got to want to try. But once they try, everybody who tries this finds it absolutely joyous. It's a joyful experience to separate from your own attachment to your opinions and let the other person into your mind.
Well, I find what you're offering here, it sounds like a great center place, and I hope it ripples out, you know, like a stone plummeting in a lake, just rippling out to those around you and communities around you and out into the world for all of us to benefit and learn from. I want to thank you today, Dr. Needleman, for offering your time so generously. I really enjoyed speaking with you today, and perhaps we can again in the future.
Oh, it would be. I would very much like it. I appreciated the conversation very much. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Thank you for calling in. And thank you, listeners, for joining us today. For more program information, you can visit us online at progressiveradionetwork.org and at godspeedinstitute.com. We will be back next week at 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time with more guests and another spiritual journey for you to come on. Until then, we wish you Godspeed.